Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hope everyone had a really great Thanksgiving break. Sagar and I certainly did. I rang in my first ever Thanksgiving in New York City. Olivia, Gorda, our dog, and I had a really great time. Sagar got to go to Costa Rica, so I think everyone got a well-deserved break from everything we're going to be doing the next few months. We're really, really, really pumped to do. So, in terms of programming this week, we have a new episode coming on Thursday, but for today, we obviously were not taping at the end of Thanksgiving, so we're going to publish the second half of our realignment conference. These were the panels. So our first panel is all about the debate over centralization and decentralization. This is about how technology and new industries, new technologies, and actually politics are going to be affected by this debate that we're seeing everywhere from Twitter to actual companies themselves. It hits a bit at the Web3 conversation we're having, and it gets to a bigger debate about censorship and different forms of moderation that everyone is really, really interested in. The second part is a really expansive conversation around the future of populism, what the show got right when we came in at the start, and what this means for the future. So this is bringing in Sam Hammond of the Niskanen Center, Julius Krein, Realignment fan favorite, editor of American Affairs Magazine, who's been on before. We did a really great episode with him immediately after the election. And then finally, we also have Wells King of American Compass, which is Orrin Cass's policy organization, joining as well. So lots and lots and lots of great stuff. We'll be back with new episodes on Thursday. But for those of you that missed out on the conference, this is a really good opportunity to talk about things that we are super interested in. And we think you will get a great taste out of this. Couple quick notes. One, we are nearing the Christmas, Hanukkah, pick your holiday set of holidays. So if you're looking for a good set of gifts, definitely go check out the Realignment Bookshop. It is directly right below you if you watch this on YouTube, or if you open up the actual episode description for this on your Spotify or Apple Podcast app, you can click to that link as well too. You can purchase all of the books of our authors. You can help support the show. You can help support local booksellers who definitely need support right now. And of course, you help authors who come on our show. We've been specifically told multiple times by rather big names that we move a lot of books. So it's really great to see that we have an audience that gets engaged this way. In the next few weeks, we're going to start actually putting out really specific book lists, our recommendations of the year, what we've been reading lately, and then just a nice little Christmas set for everyone. So definitely go take a look there. Secondly, you can subscribe to the Substack as well too. We put those out on Thursdays. That is going to be available in the show notes as well. Finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for who helped us put together this conference and all the other great stuff you're going to see today. Let's get into the episode.
So we are going to start super broad and get specific. This conversation is about internet governance. That seems very like kind of foofy, but it's kind of the big topic in the tech space right now. Where, starting, let's work our way in. Gilad, we'll go with you first. What would you say the narrative that everyone should be focusing on in the tech industry is? So for example, like, is this a big debate about tech platforms either moderating too much or censoring too little? Is this about crypto making all these debates completely irrelevant? What should be done about Donald Trump? Basically, any direction you want to take it, because we're just trying to figure out how people should be thinking about this specific moment.
It's not about the crypto one. and I don't think it's about Trump. So just proceeding by process of elimination. I think I would call out two or three things. One is, this is a point that I've been making recently. A lot of people are very, very attentive to platform governance, speech regulation online by private entities. And the conversation often runs aground when people realize, okay, so someone's got to do something about this. Wait, who, what? First Amendment, what do we do? So I do think that more attention should be paid to the responsibility of companies, of platforms that host user speech, to develop internal, like, you know, forms of self-regulation, which is kind of a dirty word, but norms, like professional values analogous to quality news media. So that's one thing that I'm paying attention to. The second thing that we, and certainly I, need to pay more attention to is the debate going on in Europe right now, because the EU, as always, is way ahead of the US when it comes to trying to actually regulate. And they're currently debating Digital Services Act, the laws that are going to seek to regulate both competition and actual, like, you know, what you might call, like, at the online policy level, what platforms are and are not allowed to do, and try to, like, identify online harms. So people should be paying attention to what's going on in Europe. And then the last thing, though, as far as, like, the domestic legislative agenda, I think competition policy, and particularly what's going on at the FTC, is the place where, like, action is actually likely.
Andrea, what do you think?
Sure. So this is kind of a broad question, so I'll give a kind of broad answer. So I guess the theme of my work and kind of the way I look at technology policy can be summed up in one word, and that's control. So when we're talking about digital technologies, who has the control? Any kind of policy debate ultimately boils down to who wields these controls and who should wield them. What kind of influence should they have on the population? In a lot of ways, it's honestly not very interesting of a question, right? Because technology is developing in ways to give control back to the user. So this is kind of one of the themes of this panel, is decentralization and centralization. Anytime you have a policy question, what should this platform do? It's because they have the ability to do it. Those users on that platform, they're basically subject to whatever rules, whatever content is allowed. And it, you know, is kind of unsatisfying for the user. When we think of things like competition policy, it's really a question of what alternatives do users have. But most of the time, those also are centralized. They're also controlled. If you are in an environment where all of these platforms are subject to similar content controls or liabilities, de facto content controls, there's not much competition there, right? So in terms of giving more control to the user to compute whatever way they want online, it's a question of decentralizing technologies. How can we encourage them? In a lot of contexts, they already exist. They might not be especially user-friendly, but the question is, how can we support those? How can we empower users in order to, you know, do what they want online, instead of having these kind of tedious, really arcane kind of debates about things like Section 230 and competition policy, the FTC. I think a lot of people just want to, like, talk to their friends online. A lot of people just want to broadcast communication online. A lot of people just want to run their businesses. They don't care about these things, right? So that's what's interesting to me, looking at these kind of shoots of decentralization and how we can best encourage them. Unfortunately, politicians, policymakers, they want to do something, right? They want to regulate something. They want to fund something. It's a much more kind of nuanced and roundabout conversation about how to encourage this environment for decentralization.
You know, Gilad, I'm curious where you can pick up on this, because one of the things you pointed to was platform governance, Europe, even in regulation. But one of the things that frustrates me, and I'm sure anybody who's ever heard us talk about this on the podcast will pick up on this, it seems that the conversation is just lagging reality. Right now, Washington and the entire country seems embroiled in a discussion over what to do about Facebook. But to me, one of the most important articles that I've read recently, you know, regarding the Facebook whistleblower, was actually an analysis of internal Facebook documents about how they're freaking out about how nobody uses Facebook anymore. And so I'm like, wait, so we're obsessing the entire national conversation while the company itself is like, oh my God, nobody's using our product. We're going to be irrelevant 5 years from now. I mean, it just seems that the conversation around what to do, misinformation and all of that, just completely lags reality, which itself just seems so intrinsic to technology itself.
I think that leak was like the best press Facebook has gotten in years because it's like, oh, look, they're not a monopoly. Look, every company worries about losing young people. Every company worries about, you know, nascent competitors, like Facebook, famously so, right? That's why they buy them all. And now that might be harder to do because of this awakened interest in antitrust. But, like, if you want to know how Facebook's fundamentals are, just, like, go on Robinhood and look at their stock price over the last year. Like, even after getting shit on for the last, can we curse on this podcast? Month or whatever, right? There's, you know, the stock is doing gangbusters. They're one of the most profitable corporations ever in terms of profit margins. So you got to take that with a grain of salt. Yes, they have problems. Young people don't use Facebook. They still use Instagram. Yes, you know, there's other places for young people to spend their time. But the better question to ask is, are there other places for digital advertisers to spend their ad budgets? And the answer is barely, right? Google, Amazon, Facebook, that's like almost the whole ballgame. So as far as that market, which is the economically relevant one, I don't think the fact that Facebook feels threatened by TikTok's growing popularity with kids means suddenly that they shouldn't be the object of scrutiny for antitrust purposes.
You know, I'm glad you put it that way, which is, and I'll pick up what Sagar's saying, which is that what we should take with that Facebook being scared point is we should update the conversation from 2017. Because this is my frustration point. The reality of TikTok, Clubhouse is a whole separate other conversation, but the reality is if you act as if the world is like the Facebook of 2017, that's just not accurate. So we can't just say, hey, Facebook is scared, so antitrust doesn't matter. But I think we can say you cannot just take talking points you were using 2016, 2017. So like the one which I'm exhausted by is, oh, like no one funds competitors because Facebook will buy everyone. Like that just isn't true. But Andrea, I want to pick up on something you said, which is that you really outlined the opportunity for decentralizing platforms, but then you went on to say most users just want to like talk to each other and hang out and sell things. So what is this adding that doesn't already exist? Because the joke I make is I have relatives who have like 300 followers on Twitter and they're like, oh my God, I'm like, I'm going to get censored. I'm like, Jack Dorsey doesn't care about you. Like the reality that's uncomfortable is that 99.999% of all users, left, right, center, like whatever, are irrelevant and are probably having a fine time on Twitter. So like, who are these nascent people who are demanding and are interested in these decentralizing systems? If by your own metric, I feel as if most people, like I used Facebook Marketplace, sorry. Marketplace to sell something last week and it was totally great. So how do you think this looks for people?
So I don't think most people actually like know that they want decentralizing technologies. And I don't think, I mean, obviously, if you post something and nobody responds, it's easier to say like, oh, I've been shadow banned instead of like, maybe that post was just lame, right? But it's not just a question of like overt like content censorship. There's dumb algorithms, right? Like they might be targeting some term that you're talking about in a like, I don't know, scientific way, if you want to say that, and it gets caught in the net. Or it could be something as prosaic as you have a business account on Facebook and it has the wrong information. This is more of a problem with Google, I think, but you know, it's a different platform, similar problem. And there's nobody you can talk to update that. And then your customers go to the wrong address. So like there's real problems with centralization on platforms. Just the fact that it's not really one size fits all. And it's because of the design of the platform. So if you are on Twitter and you don't like the way Twitter's algorithm is set up, or you know, you don't like the platform, whatever reason, you can't just leave. Yes, they're working on Blue Sky. We'll see, you know, when that comes out. But the architecture of the internet is such that you are, this is a loaded term, but it's the best kind of analogy. You're a serf, right, on that you know, plot, and your lord has the rules and you have to deal with it. There's not really a place you can go, right? As opposed to like being a landowner and like, you know, having the rights investiture with that kind of setup. So there are ways that you can, you know, have your own data and take it from place to place, right? So like APIs are like kind of like way that works right now. It's still like centrally managed, but we needed like an API for individuals, right? On the internet, on the native internet.
Say more about that? Like when you say take your data from place to place, what exactly are you talking about?
So if you're on Facebook, right? Facebook has their graph and you're, you know, you have your account and your all the data that is set up with that, right? And if you don't like Facebook or if Facebook doesn't like you, you're gone.
Right. The switching costs are too high because everyone's on Facebook. If you want to join a different social network, it's like, well, my friends aren't there. I'd have to like refriend everybody. That's what we're talking about.
It's not just switching costs of it. That is significant. Because you see all these like alternative social media networks that nobody's on. So why would you go there? Right.
It's network effects.
But this is more a question of like, here's an easy way to think about it. It's like, I have all my pictures on Facebook. I don't have a Facebook account, but let's, you know, hypothetically, I have all my pictures on Facebook.
She doesn't have Facebook.
You have a burner. She has a burner.
Yeah. I promise you, I do not. But, you know,
she got banned.
Let's say I want to leave Facebook. Well, there might be a way to take all your, you know, pictures with you, but what about like the tags, right? What about the metadata? What about all the things that go along with that? Right. And that's just one, you know, kind of data we're talking about. We're talking about pictures, but just all these different like connections, all the different like comments, everything, like everything that is you on Facebook is not portable. And that's not, I'm not beating up on Facebook. That's just how the internet was designed. Right. But it doesn't have to be that way. So, you know, there are people that are working on this, looking at things like server architecture, right? So, I mean, you can't, it is what it is for a lot of the way that the internet is built, but making it easier for you to be portable between different networks, right? And that kind of requires a reimagining of the whole internet, but there are people that are doing that. It's very exciting. And it's very difficult to explain that to politicians, especially.
Glad you want to pick up on that.
Yeah, I feel like I want to co-sign two-thirds of what Andrea just said and then disagree on the last third. Definitely, I think it's a deep point that just because people don't consciously know, like desire something that they might not really be familiar with, doesn't mean there isn't demand or that it wouldn't be good. But you know, because you could, I feel that way about a lot of potential policy interventions, right? People don't walk around being like, you know, it's really not good that Google also controls, in addition to the search advertising, all the open web programmatic advertising, right? But like, it still might make their lives better to address that. So I agree with that. And then I totally, you know, you explain the problem with, you know, not lack of portability really well. But where my mind goes is, okay, I don't think the barrier to portability is technological. Like, we don't need some technological innovation. We need someone to make Facebook and similar companies let you take your shit somewhere else.
Yeah. I mean, people are working on that, right? It's hard to get things done with government, especially now, right? Because that's what we're talking about as a policy solution.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. So let's speak to that point. The question is, why is it difficult to get things done with government? Because, like, once again, like you said, the API thing.
The Constitution.
I mean, sclerosis, right? I mean, we're kind of in a state of decline in a lot of ways. It's just very difficult to get a lot of things done, even like budget bills, right? Like very, very basic functions of government take like Herculean efforts. There's a lot of industry involved. Like there's a lot of interest groups involved that are very averse to change.
Let me pick up on that, Andrea. Do you think that it's sclerosis or do you also think that there's a knowledge gap? Because I wonder, even if, let's say it was like 1990 and, you know, government had its problems then, but it probably, they weren't worrying about clearing the debt ceiling. Would it still, let's say we still had that system and given our kind of current representation, would we still have the inaction on it? Because I'm not convinced that we would, just given the knowledge gap in Washington. I mean, when you have a congressman who every single time has to ask like Mark Zuckerberg why his Gmail account doesn't work or like why his campaign emails are getting flagged for spam, my personal favorite, or what is it? How do you make money, Mr. Zuckerberg? The famous 2000, I think.
Wait,
it was 2018.
He knew. Orrin Hatch knew that Facebook sells ads. Okay. He was just asking him to get it on the record.
All right. Well, we got an Orrin Hatch stand here on the panel, apparently. Yeah.
So I stand the truth.
All right. But my general point being that every time that these people appear before Congress, I am just stunned at how horrible the preparation, the lack of knowledge, you can call this ageism as if you want, and I know that some accusations will be thrown, but there is a massive disconnect between Congress there and just the even idea of trying to get to the bottom of a solution rather than trying to score points for cameras or just, in general, trying to make a point. Galad, I see that you have
let me just pick up to add a bit to that for a second, just disagree real quick.
Please.
There's diversity on the panel. I mean, dude, do you think that during the Cold War, like, Congress was particularly knowledgeable about like rocket technology? Like, I'm actually super skeptical of the idea that the individual knowledge level of individual like members of Congress is particularly relevant to basically any topic ever. I don't think there's ever been a golden age of like governmental like knowledge of topics.
That's a good point.
But sorry, yeah.
Our friend Zach Graves, I think this conversation is going to be triggering for him because, like, I'm sort of in right in between you guys. Like, I do think, Sagar, that the Congress has no clue what they're talking about thing. That was true 5 years ago, but I don't think it's as true anymore. I think there are members of Congress with smart staffers who have, you know, who are technologically literate, who, you know, have done their homework and understand what's going on. You know, the House did a deep, their competition report investigation last year was really, really substantive. So I don't think they're completely fumbling in the dark, but are some of them? Yes. But to Marshall's point, Congress did used to have more resources
than it has today. Did someone come in?
Don't worry. Keep going.
He's getting censored, of course. Yeah.
Big Mike is censoring me.
Hello?
Yeah. So thank you. Well, way louder too. Congress did have used to be better resourced. And one of the achievements, if you will, of the Newt Gingrich revolution was to dramatically cut congressional staff, and they killed the Office of Technology Assessment. And so like a lot of Congress's brain got kind of lobotomized in the 90s. And so if you want better policymaking, even if you want it to be in pursuit of conservative goals, you should, like, one really boring but important thing would be you need to give Congress more money to hire, you know, to hire more people and pay them better so that they actually, you know what they're doing.
So yeah, really quickly, I definitely agree there is a knowledge gap. I want to say there are some people that are like very knowledgeable, particularly in the Senate. I don't know how old like Mark Warner or sorry, that's not the one I'm thinking of. I'll just say Cynthia Lummis, of Wyoming. She's quite knowledgeable on Bitcoin, but she, is no spring chicken, right? So there are very, very knowledgeable folks in the Senate. But I challenge people in general to think, like, what is one big government success you can think of in just the past, like, 5 or 10 years? Like, you're probably going to have to strain, right, to think of a good one. And even then, it's probably going to be, kind of minute. Like I said, we struggle to even pass a budget. Basic thing, everyone knows we need a budget. And because of, partisanship, because of, again, industry interests, I don't want to just say industry, just interests generally, it's just hard to get things done. So I would put more eggs in the sclerosis basket.
Hmm. It's interesting. I am more aligned with the sclerosis point, but in a way that kind of disagrees with what you're saying, Gilad, in the sense that when you talk about, and no offense, Zach, to your body of work and the fact that you're my boss, but I don't think that if you brought back the Office of Technology Assessment or doubled the number of congressional staff and made sure they all had PhDs from MIT, you would actually see any more action regarding these issues. Because like the bigger problem, and this is feeds into sclerosis, is, and I'm less personally bought into the whole like government's incompetent, therefore that's the problem. I just think there's no actual consensus in our society. And actually, if there was a consensus in our society that let's take the content moderation debate. Like, let's just say 70% of the American people believe that it is bad that platforms could either moderate if you're like center left or censor if you're center right, depending on what language you use. I actually think something would quote unquote happen. I think if you're looking at most of these tech issues, especially those which align with the culture war, you actually just find that the country is split like 55, 45. And that's why nothing's happening. And adding new staff isn't going to actually change that dynamic.
But now I'm going to like out pessimistic you. I think there's more consensus. Like everyone wants, like raising taxes on the wealthy is really popular. Lowering, like letting the government negotiate with prescription, like for over prescription drug prices is super popular, right? And it still doesn't get done. Does this like auto kill when I get too close to it? So I think like even places where there's more consensus, stuff still doesn't get done. So I'm going to like jump ahead of you guys on the pessimism about sclerosis front there. Like, I don't think the lack of consensus on tech regulatory issues is like distinctive, if that makes sense.
Can I back up a little
bit? Yeah, please.
We talked about Facebook and antitrust and these things earlier. And I think one thing that's kind of underappreciated. So we were talking about Facebook being worried about having young people, which is totally true. I think most people in this room are not like glued to Facebook. Probably our parents are, right? And that I think is almost as relevant, if not more. Just Facebook and platforms in general, just as like the new cable in that it is a influence conduit, right? This is how the misinformation, disinformation debate, what we're talking about is what people in this country believe. So it's not just about like advertising dollars or who controls most of the market, it's who controls what people can see. We're not just talking about things like politics either, right? We're talking about like going back to advertising, like can you influence people to buy this product. There was that big story with Facebook doing research on affecting people's moods. That's just what we know about, right? So it is very much a, like it's just like our infinite information nexus. So when we're talking about like different policies, often it's not even like the policy itself isn't the end goal. It's just kind of the threat to these platforms. Like you need to start doing this or else, we might go after you more seriously. It's a subtext, again, of control, right? In that how can you, this is kind of like a leftist concept, right? But like, sorry, just influencing society, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's a very powerful element of these platforms, and that's kind of underspoken of, I think, in these debates.
I want to pick up on that because this is I think the best point to counter what could possibly be a moral panic around this is back in the 1990s, there was an epidemic of like anorexia and bulimia, which unquestionably had to do with the way that mainstream media and the magazine industry were portraying women. Very similar to maybe how Instagram, you know, its own data shows it. But there was not a national call to action in politics to censor the magazine industry and the mainstream media. Now, maybe there should have been. But what do you think makes Facebook and technology so radically different from that same problem set that we faced back in the 1990s? And that's to both of you.
Well, I mean, like, there's a lot you could say about that analogy. I think it's fair to point out that, I mean, this is partly an answer to your question, right? Like, magazines weren't definitionally different in the 90s than they were in the 40s, right? It was still like a thing on paper and had pictures in it of pretty women. And, you know, social media is such a different thing. So people always freak out about things that are very different. Another like salient difference, of course, that Instagram is participatory. So it invites users to put themselves, like, you don't submit your own photo to Vogue and then they run it and then all your friends can dump on how bad you look or praise you for how good you look, unless you're a model. So it is very different. Having said that, I do want to point out that the internal data from Facebook on this particular question is very equivocal. It really doesn't prove the point that people are saying, not to be like a Facebook shill, but I think this is like one of the weakest places to attack them based on what we know for sure from these disclosures. It doesn't really prove that Instagram is killing our youth, even if that feels intuitively likely.
And I hate to do this, but we should hit the audience Q&A portion right now. Not to give you the last word on your Facebook shilling. Okay, any questions? How are we going to do this?
Got a question right there.
Hi, this isn't a question, just in terms of the analogy with anorexia. I think the modeling industry did have a lot of pushback in terms of girls' weights, you know.
Right.
I would like to jump on that just really quickly.
Yeah,
I
please.
Think, you know, the recent report obviously is about like teen girls and their, you know, self-worth, whatever. But I think like we have to think about social media a lot deeper. It's not just like, oh, you know, do I look fat in this picture? It's changed our way of relating to people. Like, how many times have you caught yourself saying, I want to post this because I want to get likes, right? And like, how much are we doing things just for that? And like, how does it make us think about ourselves and how we perform for people online or, you know, in person? This is like kind of like a Marshall McLuhan point, but it's really changing our conceptions of selves. And that has big implications, obviously, for the body politic as well and the control that they might have on us.
I really agree. It's just kind of harder to measure.
Yeah. Interesting. Any other questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Decentralization and control early on. And I was just wondering, you know, like we have decentralization right now for 240 characters on the Fediverse, but it takes a little bit more effort than going to Twitter and having everything just work like magic. Do you think we should have higher expectations for users if they want control? And what do you think is like a reasonable amount of effort that we should expect from people in order to like own their data and have control?
Yeah, no, I think that's totally right. And I'm going to like put myself on blast here. Like, so my husband is a software developer and like he helps me set these things up, right? So like if I was on my own, like I'm very much interested in these questions, but like would I take the effort, right? So in my case, it's just having like a husband who can teach me, so perhaps education. But I think you're absolutely right. We should expect more of users, and I don't know how to get them there, right? But I think just, you know, in this conversation and kind of the national conversation, people are unsatisfied. How do we get from A to B? I'm not sure, but I think you're absolutely right.
We had another question.
These are like four of my favorite people on stage. This is great.
No comments. Stop.
Anyway,
how many people would say that?
like me and Zach. Glad Nathan Lemer, a big Twitter fan of yours. I discovered you because of your 230 article, which I think is a masterpiece. And I think it was like a transcendent conversation.
Speeches, Nathan.
No, my whole point is, I'm getting here.
I want to hear where he's going with this.
It was a phenomenal article. My question to you is, do you think the reaction that you received, particularly from the negative side of that article, was in good faith? And kind of like, what did you learn through that process?
1 second. Can you go ahead and describe the article?
I'll do it as fast as I can. Yeah. Right. I did it for Wired, for the cover of Wired, earlier this year. I did a deep dive in Section 230. The headline was, "Everything you've heard about Section 230 was wrong," because I was frustrated that I was frustrated by the fact that the positions that people had the most exposure to were either Donald Trump saying, you know, things that were completely off base, or people just saying like sort of like a mirror image from the left that was kind of equally off base. So it just, you know, I explored the legal history of it, and I observed that like it sort of had the effect of cutting off what would have been a normal judicial process of figuring out, hey, what should the liability rules be for the internet? And so we shouldn't be, basically where I landed was, there are some pretty sensible ways to reform it without getting rid of it that would not cause the sky to fall. And one thing that I noted is that the counter argument to that is kind of an all-purpose libertarian argument against regulation, which like may be right situationally, but is not, when you notice that it's the same response to any proposed regulation, whether it's Section 230 or otherwise, it gets a little bit less compelling. So the reaction was the reaction in good faith? I don't know.
What was the reaction? Why don't you describe that?
Well, they hard paywalled it, so not that much. little insider media biz for you. You know, it was a mixed bag. Like there's a small group of people who are sort of professional Section 230 defenders, and they say look, we, you know, Section 230 isn't perfect, but don't change a hair on its head. So they're like, Section 230 may not be perfect, but like every possible solution would be infinitely worse. That's how they reacted to my article, right? People got pretty mad. That crew got pretty upset because they accused me of misrepresenting them, but what I had actually done, of course, was just represent them and disagreed with them. So they didn't like that I said they were wrong. But was it, you know, I tend to think, I go into things assuming people believe things. And if they're shills, they get selected to be the shill because they already believe the thing, because it's easier to pick shills on that basis.
It's well said. And that's something that not enough people online pick up on. I'm sorry, audience. I have to follow up on that because it is important on 230, which is that and did you find that any of this discussion around 230 is actually about 230, or picking up what Andrea has been talking about, was it really just about control?
No, a lot of it is about 230, but it's helpful to not focus your attention on Facebook or Google or Twitter and think more about, there are websites that are essentially harassment, like websites that are devoted to harassment. There are sites that are like built for people to submit, you know, nude photos of people and talk about what a homewrecker or a slut they are. Like, whatever you think how to regulate Facebook or Twitter is much more complicated than, should it be legal? Should you be allowed to essentially invite defamation, profit from it, and then say, well, users submitted this, so we're good to go. Mm-hmm. So some of the most thoughtful Section 230 critics, like from the left, from like a women's rights perspective, is how a lot of them got into it. They're, you know, that's very sincere, but that is about Section 230. That's like, there are certain just nakedly indefensible business models that Section 230 protects, and that ought not to be the case. And then where the modal response to that is, well, yeah, but if you changed it to address that, then you'd open up all these other unintended consequences. So sorry to the lady who's being slut shamed or whatever by a vindictive former lover, but you can't fix that without ruining everything else.
Any more audience questions? Last question.
Sorry for going long on 230. Read the article.
It's a good question.
I found the analogy that you made earlier about how the internet is sort of in a feudal state right now really interesting. And I'm wondering if all of the problems that we're seeing in internet governance right now are just downstream of the fact that our jurisprudence, our legal system, all of it was built for an industrial society and not for a digital age. And have you seen, or you, Gilad, have you seen any examples of second or third world countries that are just now really getting their jurisprudence and their regulatory structures up to code that are much better at responding to how life, property, data, and all the rest of it actually works in the 21st century.
So I think some of it is jurisprudence. Some of it is just, you know, pacing problem, right? The fact that laws update so slowly, and then when they do update, they're often quite bad. ECPA, things like that. But I think a lot of it is just when the internet was developing, it was pretty hacky, right? It's just like at the time that might have been the cheapest way to do something or just the easiest. Maybe it would have been a lot more expensive or, you know, processing intensive to do it differently at the time. And people need to make money, right? Like if, as the internet developed and you have like VC pouring in, there's those sets of incentives there. So I don't think it's just a problem of law. I think it's just kind of, that's how the internet was hacked together as well. And laws may reinforce or undermine that depending on what policy we're talking about.
Great point. Okay, why don't we give a hand to the panel? They did a great job. Thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So this is our final panel. This is actually the most personal panel for the two of us to speak for Sagar for a second, because when we came up with the idea for the realignment back in 2019, we didn't quite know you yet, Wells, no offense, but we're a little newer to the scene, but like the institutions that you all are at played a huge role in coming up with the show. So American Affairs, a journal that was doing really serious policy work, the prelude to American Compass, which is Oren Kastis's work at the Manhattan Institute. And then Sam, like your work at Niskanen, like once again, you're writing along heterodox issues from like a really policy centric lens. So I want to use this panel to basically just like reflect upon the 2.5 years since we launched. We said this pretty explicitly during the show, but I look back at our first season and I think it's just total cringe. I think we were basically wrong about everyone and everything. There's lots of examples of us saying, oh, like the neoliberal world order failed in 2016. And now the populace of the left and right rise and do this, and that. And that was all just totally wrong, notwithstanding COVID. So I think it'd be great just to hear from each of you coming from a journal, a advocacy organization, and a think tank, where the three of you just see this broad narrative of a political realignment of ideologies and ideas really standing. Let's start with you, Julius.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And I'm glad I appeared, I think, on like the second or third season of your show. So
smarter.
Yeah. I think you've been on twice, to be fair.
I think it's been really interesting. I would sort of posit a dichotomy. On the one hand, American Affairs started 5 years ago. And back then, the words industrial policy, you couldn't even say them in play company. So there has been meaningful shifts in one might call the intellectual landscape, or this seems like an antonym, but it's not, the aesthetic landscape in how politicians campaign and so on. And you saw that not only with Trump or whatever, but even the fact that Biden, nominally center-left establishment guy, position himself as seemingly very progressive on a lot of spending policy, and also Trumpian on Made in America and some of those things. But then, of course, in actual policy changes, there's been much less happening. And even more so, I think, if you look at the actual business world and the underlying business dynamics, almost nothing has changed, particularly if you look at neoliberalism as I do. Is, you know, one of the key shifts from Fordism is, in Fordism, you had the most profitable companies were also the highest spenders on CapEx, labor, the biggest investors. In neoliberalism, you have a separation or disaggregation of all of that. And I would say, despite the fact of a lot of policy improvements in the last several years, nothing's really been done to shift that underlying dynamic.
Hmm. What do you think, Wells?
First, thanks so much for having me. Compass was launched in May of 2020, so fairly new, about a year and a half old. But what we found, at least, and of course, our project is primarily aimed at sort of the center right, thinking about what a new economic consensus would look like on the center right. So really sort of trying to challenge and really, I think, force debates and questions that maybe institutions, scholars, politicians on the right of center aren't necessarily used to asking on a range of questions from industrial policy to labor to education policy. What we found is that ourselves, including a number of other sort of quote unquote dissident right types of publications and organizations, think tanks and so on, are now somewhat mainstream. Are now considered a part of the conversation, are included with a lot of the legacy orgs that have been around for 40 plus years on the right of center. So to the extent that our org, the types of arguments we're making on policy change in terms of thinking about what a conservative working class type of coalition looks like have been brought into the mainstream on the right of center, it's very encouraging. When it comes to sort of longer term policy changes, I think that's long down the line. I think that Julius is absolutely right. This is a longer project. And even I think sort of the move beyond a neoliberal consensus, it's a sort of a tectonic shift, right? It happens slowly, even imperceptibly, and then kind of all at once. And we've yet to see that sudden shift. But at least within the right of center, what we're seeing is an acknowledgement that there are certain questions that haven't been asked, especially in economic policy, and a real need to reconsider our priors.
Yeah. You know, I think it's sort of a symptom of the current state of affairs that there wasn't as big of realignment as you expected, right? Because, you know, people have been predicting a fourth or fifth turning. I don't know which turning we're on now.
We're on the fourth. Yeah. Sorry.
You know, every 8 years or 4 years, it's like, this is the one. And the reason it's not, and there's clearly like lots of bottom-up forces that should be making it the one. But the fact that it isn't is partly a symptom of the fact that, you know, one way of thinking about what the neoliberal era was this sort of shift to what Nicholas Bagley has called procedural fetishism. Just, you know, put government on rails. Now, this is why the FDA was such a shit show during the pandemic, because they have to basically follow the rules. There's no one really in charge. And that means that, like, the ship can just keep sailing without a captain. But then it also means that when you have a change election with Obama or with Trump, or, you know, nothing really changes, nothing happens. And there's no clear mechanism to make things happen, right? And that's the most concerning part, right? Because it's like a pressure cooker that keeps building up and building up. And the only way that we're going to get real change at the level of like deep structural reform is to actually in some ways reverse partisan polarization, because, you know, I think moderate gets a bad term in part because it's identified with graft and corruption and warmongering and stuff like that. But that's not like inherent to the concept of moderation. Or it's likewise with liberalism. Like liberalism, small L liberalism is a thing. But then when we use the term in American context, we're referring basically to like people who were, you know, tearing down pieces of the Berlin Wall and and now have like a boomer liberal establishment complex around it. So what that means is like to actually, you know, whatever, do deep civil service reform or to repeal and replace the FDA with something that's actually like 21st century, you're going to actually need a new social consensus that is transpartisan that crosses the aisle. And there's nothing like that in sight.
I think that's really well said. I mean, Julius, this one's really for you. I'm thinking back to when I was most excited about your work, some of your most incisive critiques of the establishment American right. And I think one of the more reasons that I was so excited that, you know, a change or replacement or whatever, fourth turning would finally happen, was that they were so, you know, pathetic, inept, and you know, really just failed so miserably. And yet what ended up replacing it just seems to be like boomer, MAGA, cringe. And so I'm curious, you know, for your current read on the situation, whether I'm being too pessimistic as to whether that's just the inevitable end state, as somebody who, like your journal, which is actually concerned with changing the way that American business conducts itself and the way that anybody in power would exercise it to make America in more resilient or, you know, even maybe to the past. I'm curious for your thoughts.
First, I think you're right. The Republican Party had a lot of chances to reform itself and become something serious. And it essentially refused every one of them, aside from a few isolated cases where, you know, maybe Bob Lighthizer ended up being in the right place at the right time. But there's no question that I think the right has been a tremendous disappointment. The other element, though, I think is, to Sam's point, we have this incredible polarization on the culture wars, and that actually prevents any potential realignment or new alliance forming where there is increasing agreement on economic policy and issues like that. And what you're seeing, you know, the way that plays out on the right in particular is that the sort of interesting people on the right are not really able to raise enough money from either the Republican donors or the corporate sector to drive the party. And at the same time, they are stuck in the culture wars such that they can't actually leave the party. So they can't drive the bus and they can't get off the bus. They're just stuck in the back complaining. And it doesn't work.
You know, something I'm curious about from all of you, and this has probably come out in the show recently, is we started the show interested deeply in the right. And I've increasingly found myself more interested in what's happening on the left, especially the center left, in the sense that, to speak to Jacob Hoberg's panel, which was our second one today, him discussing the real debates in the Biden administration over whether or not they're going to prioritize climate change, a big climate change deal, or serious Cold War level competition with China. That's a debate that's very active and is very interesting to me. You could pick other issues like the debate, or like Eric Adams versus Andrew Yang. So this debate about what Democrats purposely running to the right on crime in a way that mixes these traditional things, especially given the way black voters are actually voting when you have the Joe Biden, Eric Adams on the ballot. So just could each of you give me your assessment of like the state of the center left to left as we think about these things? Starting with you, Wells.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, right? Because when you think sort of about kind of when the realignment moment or sort of kind of debates and conversations in Washington on your podcast began, it was really, I think, thinking about the promise of Bernie Sanders and the far left. Yeah. The set of questions they were asking around trade and immigration, assuming alignment with Donald Trump, and of course, sort of shifts in voters and coalitions. I think what you're seeing now is something of a correction there. And I do think that some of the failures of the Republican Party to, I think, take advantage of the Trump administration, the moment that it had, the seeming course correction that it had seemed to chart on economic policy, its failure to actually take advantage of that to really lead to any real sort of lasting effective policy change, I think has left a window for sharp, perceptive folks on the center left who see the opportunity, at least sort of see the way the coalitional winds are blowing, to take advantage on issues like China, where they're right to say it's a Cold War level threat, but that doesn't mean we have to adopt the same policies that we had during the Cold War, right? Which is, I think, what you tend to hear on the right of center. So I think they're able to take advantage of some of the missed chances that Trump had and that Republicans continue to miss.
Yeah, the center left, like in some ways on the surface, you could think about the way Biden has positioned this administration as sort of picking up where Trump left off, doing like a real Buy America plan. You know, it's very obviously union driven policy. But the real issue I see is we're sort of in this catch 22 where you almost have to vote Democrats to be like responsible, because that's like where all the college educated professional people are that can actually like run in government. Even if you disagree with their policies, like that, and that's a bad equilibrium, right? We need more college educated Republicans so that we could actually have, like, even if you knew the cadre of people that would staff a Trump administration, you're drawing from such a shallow pool of people, and half of them are constitutional legal scholars. So that's one element of it. And then the other element is like many of the areas where we need big change, and even some, you know, more thoughtful people on the left recognize this, are all things that go directly against incumbent entrenched interest groups on the left, right? You know, American Compass has been doing lots of work on labor law reform and stuff right. like that. And you could imagine like a clean slate labor law reform where we have like a better, get rid of the Wagner Act, maybe bring in sectoral bargaining or something different. But that can't go through the Democratic Party because that would require, you know, they couldn't even pass a healthcare expansion that might disrupt, you know, some union's employer plan, you know? And it's the same thing with, you know, large power centers like the foundations, which you know, going to the point about why hasn't a realignment occurred, you know, if you look at other countries, a realignment seems to have occurred in Great Britain. There, you know, Aaron O'Toole didn't win in Canada, but that was a big shift in their platform. You haven't seen the same shifts in the States, in part because of all this deep institutional hangover, right, or overhang, where whether it's, and that's partly because of the separation between the political actors actually implementing policy and the foundations and institutions that are like set in stone and persist regardless of everything else going on and have, you know, endowments that they can just keep doing the same thing forever. And so like this is the paradox, like if we really want to get a clean slate labor law reform or like reform environmental review or, you know, do any of these big things, they're probably going to have to come through the Republican Party. But then that paradox is, you know, MTG does not have a deep policy backbench.
What do you think, Julius?
Yeah, I was going to, for a moment, try to defend the Republican Party a little bit and just sort of point out that, you know, despite their incredible advantages, the Democrats apparently are unwilling to sort of stand up to their fringes. And so the Republicans are likely to take the House and, who knows, have a decent shot in 2024. But then I thought better of it, and knowing my audience, I think I'll just blame Republicans some more. And no, I mean, I think it really does come down to sort of a patronage problem. And the fact is that you just have this sort of narrow sliver of Republican donors that keeps the party going down one tack, and the rest of it has sort of been, you know, bought without being paid for, essentially, and that unwillingness or inability to alter that dynamic basically allows the left to be much less responsible than it should be.
I think it's worse than that, though, Julius, because it's not that they can't go against their fringe. They can't do that either, but they can't go against the center. They can't go against.
They can't go against.
We're having a supply chain crisis right now because they can't make the port workers work.
However you want to define it, they can't drive a real agenda. Sure.
Here's where I'm curious. You know, on the donor thing, I'm not downplaying the role of donors, but here's more where, you know, this is my more pessimistic side. Do Republican voters care at all? Because it seems to me the answer is no. Which is that the reason that the donors are successful is because the politicians can do their economic bidding while, you know, paying lip service to whatever somebody's pissed off about, and they will not suffer any consequences whatsoever. And so within that set of incentives, which, you know, I mean, it is a democracy, is it even possible to try and see any sort of the changes that maybe any of us would want on this panel come from the right? I'd love to hear from all three of you on that one. Julius, you can start.
I'm getting too much airtime. No, I mean, I'll see your pessimism and I'll raise you more pessimism. I mean, the idea that people are going to get really upset and call their congressman and that's going to result in any change, it's silly. So, I mean, we nominally have a democracy, but I think one could genuinely question to what extent that really applies and to what extent we're really more of an oligarchy. And under that scenario, I think if you're being honest, the only way you really get reforms is if a significant portion of the oligarchy genuinely wants to do something more than run up their personal asset score, which so far we haven't really seen.
I think it's also worth noting that a lot of conservative donors do actually care about the culture war fights.
Very true. Small donors especially.
And not just small dollar, but big donors as well. And they want to pivot the direction of think tanks and other orgs to focus on those types of issues. If that's to distract from, say, some of the economic policy debates on the right now, it's anyone's guess. But it is the fact that it's not just some kind of a LARP to sort of distract from any kind of meaningful change. There is donor support for the culture war fights on the right, not only sort of the political, sort of on campaigns and in Congress, but also within orgs. And there are a number of new orgs being set up, well-funded, well-endowed, that are doing exactly this. They're waging the culture war well, and doing so with trying to learn the lessons from Trump. And I think for a lot of these donors, that was the lesson of Trump, was kind of go along with sort of the economic agenda of the past, but dial up the culture war a little bit more.
Huh. Interesting.
My problem with the culture war is I think it's an epiphenomena, right? Like you can scream at the school board for having CRT in the classroom or something like that, but really that's like the rank and file surface level interface with much deeper differences in power structures, basically. And so we'll continue to fight different culture wars as long as that distribution of social power is very unbalanced. And the biggest, you know, institutional overhang of all is really a demographic overhang, right? And, you know, Nancy Pelosi's like 102. You know, the average age of a CEO has increased by 14 years across 14 years. You know, there's going to be a, you know, they say progress is like one funeral at a time, and we're about to get an awful lot of progress, right? And it's unclear what that actually means, because it's going to be this demographic turnover where our generation suddenly starts being in the driver's seat, and we have very different formative experiences, very different presuppositions. And then it's like everything changes all at once, or does it? But I think more than anything, it's just going to be really messy.
Can I just jump in one second? Because I want to add on the point of the donors and the culture war. It's a very interesting kind of set of extremism and then lack of seriousness on the other hand. So a lot, you know, very concerned about abortion, but if you want to talk about family policy, I'm not sure. When the culture war starts to interfere with cutting taxes, then there's a pullback. So Israel, great. Can we talk about Israeli industrial policy? Well, maybe not. So just an odd mix there of extremism and then a lack of seriousness.
I can give you a great example of that. I do at Niskanen, I do a lot of family policy, like child tax credits and stuff like that. Heritage put out a recent report on family policy. This is their answer to family policy, and they had a lot of good ideas in it, right? But then one of the bullet points was reduce the capital gains tax. Right? Because then you get
that's why I'm not married. So I think it's good they were working.
You should have put carried interest in there too. You're really.
So here's something, not to speak ill of a panelist who's no longer here. I really disagreed with Mike Solana when he said that AOC is in charge of the Democratic Party. It's very hard as someone who studies this space to look at how the progressive movement has evolved since we started in 2019 and think in any way whatsoever they're in the driver's seat. Because and yes, you could obviously say, like, oh, like there's CRT things, but that's not like the Bernie project. That's not, if you look at like, you know, the media side facing things like, you know, Red Scare or even like that's not their thing. So what has happened to the progressive left after the Bernie repudiation, after they kind of hit their narrative high point in 2019? Just how should we think about them as a category? We could start with Sam to give Julius a break.
So, you know, one way that the current era is sort of aberrant is the extent to which Congress is very consolidated under party leadership. And that has had the effect of tamping down different factional differences within both parties, right? And, you know, Mitch McConnell is like amazing at somehow just keeping things together. And Nancy Pelosi is even more amazing at it. And at some point they're, you know, when they retire and you get in someone who's a little more, carries a little less respect and authority, you know, the Steve Tellis thesis that the future is faction might end up coming true, where you have like a very coherent progressive faction, more moderate, you know, market liberal faction, a more conventional conservative faction and a populist conservative faction. And they actually sort of work independently and maybe even find, you know, weird odd bedfellow coalitions, right? Like I'm pretty sure AOC and Mike Lee would both like decriminalize psychedelic mushrooms or something. You know, there's lots of weird things that you could imagine happening that are just impossible right now because of a self-imposed rule that we don't put a vote on the floor unless we have a majority of our own party supporting it. So I think in some ways the high water mark, we haven't reached the high water mark of either the progressive faction or the populist faction, because right now their actual degrees of freedom to assert themselves are being controlled. And you see that with the reconciliation debate where, you know, they're pushing, you know, they make these idle threats to like tank the whole thing if we don't get whatever Medicare for all and whatever thing they want. But then it just, you know, 2 days later, they have a meeting with Nancy Pelosi and they shut up about it.
And they're controlled not just by, I think, sort of the grip that leadership in Congress has over them, but also I think just by the sort of class that runs campaigns and their staffs in Washington. I think you just can sort of see from just the shift from 2015 Bernie to 2019 Bernie, the change in the staff, change in the messaging, emphasis on culture war. I mean, this is a point that's been observed again and again, but really is worth noting that I do think that sort of the political class in Washington did sort of latch on to the progressive movement as sort of the political future and did water down the message in a way that didn't appeal to the grassroots. We also really haven't had, I think, a proper political test of it yet. I do think 2020 was so, it centered so heavily around Trump and who could beat Trump that I don't think that we've seen a proper test yet of the progressive view, the progressive agenda on the national stage. And I would agree insofar with the claim, at least, that the progressives are in the driver's seat, in at least when it comes to sort of agenda setting. The Green New Deal is the sort of climate plan that everyone's going to talk about still. It is ambitious in scope. It sets a clear vision, a clear agenda, same with Medicare for All. We can dispute the specifics. We can dispute it's too big, but it is at least the direction that the Democratic Party seems to be drifting in. It may not be where the political center is today, but I do think that they are in the driver's seat in terms of generating the new ideas that are getting the buzz.
That's a good point.
I forgot who said this first, so I'm going to steal it shamelessly, but I can't attribute it properly. But, you know, if we think of the New Deal Democratic Party as fairly unified on economics and then having divergent wings on culture, the modern Democratic Party, after all of the reshuffling and picking up constituencies from the Republicans and so on, now is fairly unified on culture and has divergent wings on economics. And I think that dynamic makes it very difficult in public for the party to go against the more radical progressive wing on the agenda, despite the fact that when it actually comes to getting things done, the progressives are going to find it very difficult within that party coalition.
Julius, one of the things that you once said that really stuck with me was that in America, we really just have one party rule. We either have New Deal state, whether you know, to the degrees of which, either a neoliberal state, again, the degrees in which both parties. And the question is that in this moment of flux, and this is for all three of you, what does a post-neoliberal America one-party rule look like? Not what would you like it to look like, what might it actually look like in practice? Sam, you can start.
It's hard to know. I mean, technology is moves faster than institutions. And so, you know, at some point, the fact that, you know, the Social Security Administration maintains a retrofitted coal mine in Pennsylvania where they just have hundreds of workers who take they're down the coal mine, partly because it's like shielded from cosmic rays or something like that. And they, you know, they take PDFs and then they print them out and then they file them in filing cabinets. You know, when everything's going to be, once everything's on the blockchain, that's going to see, that already seems kind of absurd, right? But like, these things won't go on forever. I don't think we're going to have one party rule just because the politics don't work out. Like this is still a broadly center right country. You know, Democrats are barely hanging on and they're like more short-pilled by the day. They're figuring out that they like really need to maintain some of these.
Could you explain that?
David Shore's just point that, you know, maybe the
Indian voters, the abolish like the police
didn't really
dude.
Help with the Rio Grande Valley. Right? To like tamp down on the things that are divisive. And we need, you know, if you want more Democrats to, if you want a majority in the Senate, say, you know, maybe let Joe Manchin be Joe Manchin. Right. But one of the other things that is affecting this is also the shift in how campaigns are funded, right? Where you don't have to go to the big name donors. You don't have to appease the normal gatekeepers. In the same way we're seeing with media, that kind of splintering, you're going to have more just raw free agents that are, and that's going to have to drive a degree of factionalization within the parties because you're going to have progressives being progressives, but for them to not tear down their national electoral prospects, there's going to have to be some product differentiation to say, I'm voting for the Democratic Party, but I don't associate Kristen Sinema with whomever on the far left.
Go ahead, Wells.
When it comes to, I think, sort of a potential one-party rule, I do think it would be centered on some kind of a new economic consensus of some kind. I think the biggest barrier to that right now, beyond just sort of the party establishments from an issue standpoint, is immigration. I don't know how that debate gets settled. But once it is, however it is, I do think that there is a pathway on issues from education to trade to tech where I do think you could find some kind of a bipartisan, effectively one-party consensus rule. It's on issues of society and culture that I don't think we're going to be able to settle at the national level. And once they are, we'll see how the Dobbs case goes. You will, I think, see an acceleration at state and local levels. And that'll be one of the principal arenas where sort of the factionalism on social and cultural lines takes place.
What does one-party rule look like in the United States? Three letters, CCP. No. I'm just kidding, of course. I think the only thing I could add to the previous comments, the British commentator, Philip Cunliffe, said something like, it was easier for the left in Britain to imagine the end of capitalism than to imagine the end of Europe. And I think it's actually maybe easier for Americans to imagine the end of neoliberalism than it is to imagine the end of the American empire, at least in the moral sense of where they sort of take their moral bearings. And I think a sort of new humility around internal improvements and internal reforms would have to be the basis of any future-looking consensus. But that is not a prediction that we'll get there, only that we'll need to.
Yeah, well said.
So my last question before we get to our last Q&A. We're hitting it.
The nod.
We got the nod.
We can do one question.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, one quick question from the audience.
We have a winner.
Thanks for a great panel. Is this working?
No, yeah. You're good.
Okay. You guys mentioned Boris Johnson. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on how much of a realignment really has occurred in the UK, whether they've really seen progress on certain issues.
Who wants to take that? Go ahead, Sam.
The Canadian, please.
Yeah, I think they have seen a realignment, partly because the Conservative Party in a parliamentary system is more like integrated, vertically integrated. They're not like turning to big think tanks or foundations that they're outsourcing policy to that never change. So it has meant that with the big shift of working class voters away from Labour into that party, that they're actually having to realign from at the top, right? I think they're going in a direction that's not like, is less like American compass, social conservatism, and more like more space force, you know, like they had like Dominic Cummings running around building new science agencies and stuff like that. And I think that is part, you know, in the European / British context, like that, the main axis is this kind of Euroscepticism and a fear of technocracy vis-a-vis like popular sovereignty. And that doesn't necessarily cut on like left-right culture, economic issues. It's more about that's actually like have control of our economy, and that will come to the U.S. at some point, right? Because things feel very static at the moment. But at the end of the day, Congress has basically delegated all this power, and they can take it back. They just needs to either get really, really bad or really, really obvious that they need to.
That is an excellent place to end things.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.